Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And welcome into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley in for Braden Gall today alongside Derek Mason and Marquise Munson. Taking you through this Monday morning after a big Titans win against the New England Patriots. We'll get into plenty of that coming up. But first, Preds fans, don't miss this Wednesday night's edition of Smashville Live. We'll be in Bellevue at Brewhouse 100, located at 80 through 98 Highway 100, and the show starts at 7 p.m. This week's guests will be Ida Bjornstedt and Julie Turris of the podcast Off Ice with Ida and Julie, which is a great podcast. This Wednesday night, Smashville Live is brought to you by New Amsterdam Vodka, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, Yeehaw Brewing Company, and Red Spirits and Wine, so make sure to tune in for that. Always a fun time on Smashville Live. And the Predators, D-Mace, had kind of a mixed bag this weekend. Went to L.A. on Saturday night, got a big win against the L.A. Kings, 4-1 against a team they absolutely should have beaten, the second worst team in the Western Conference, followed up last night with a shootout loss to the Anaheim Ducks in a game where they were totally dominated in the first period, battled back in the second period to take a 2-1 lead, got down 4-2, and then battled back once again in the third period to force overtime, and then ultimately couldn't get it done in the shootout. Had a great chance in overtime to win the game last night. Rocco Grimaldi had a breakaway and was stopped by John Gibson on literally the goal line. Another inch the other way, and the Predators would have won that game last night. But just that's kind of how things have been going lately for the Predators in terms of the way they've been playing. Didn't play poorly last night, got really torched on the power play by the Ducks, but a mixed bag this weekend in Southern California. So as they move forward here this week, got a big week this week at home against Boston tomorrow. Obviously the biggest part of that schedule, got to win your home games, which has been a struggle for the Predators as of late, but they've already beaten the Boston Bruins once so far this year. So D-Mace, it'll be interesting to see if the Predators can get back on track this week, starting tomorrow against the Boston Bruins.
Again, it's the, and you know better than I do, Robbie, it's the same old story.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you win one game in the fashion that we believe you should be winning games, period.
Yeah.
You beat the Kings 4-1 and you dominate that game, and then you come back and, you know, after the first period is 1-1, but then all of a sudden they get three unanswered goals. Well, two, because you respond to one of them. And it's like, how can you play one way one period and then another way another period and then play good again? Yeah. It's just so I just don't. It's like the tale of three teams. You know, it's we play good, play bad, play good, get in overtime, and then we, and, you know, when you get in overtime, it's shootout, and luckily you still get a point.
Right.
But still, it's just, this is what I guess people are so frustrated by, the inconsistency of this team. You beat one team, and then you lose to another that you should beat.
Yeah, there's no question. They should have won both of these games this weekend. And, you know, obviously the back-to-back, it's tough to play, but travel was not much of an issue. Obviously, the distance between L.A. and Anaheim is not very much. So the travel part of the back-to-back gets thrown out the window for me, not to mention the fact the Predators have played in fewer games than anybody else in the Western Conference. But, you know, we're getting to the point of the season now where it's critical mass. Like, you've got to get it figured out really soon. Like, I'm talking this week soon, or it's going to be really tough. You're going to be fighting an uphill battle after that. And, just being in the locker room last week after the loss to the Winter Classic, I mean, it was dead silent in there. And it's just one of those games where, you know, it's a regular season game, but it doesn't really have a regular season feel to it. It felt bigger than that. And you heard all week long about maybe some meetings they had had after that game and trying to get things figured out and moved in the right direction. They played well against the LA Kings on Saturday night. And then they came out last night against the Ducks, and they were outshot 21-4 in the first period against a pretty bad Anaheim team, if I'm being honest with you. So I tweeted this out last night. It's part of what's maddening about the Predators, because they came out in the third period when they were down 4-2 and were just all over the Ducks. They were shooting pucks from everywhere. They were pushing the pace offensively. They ended up tying the game and getting a point out of it, which obviously is very good news for them. But the question then becomes, why do you have to be down 4-2 in order to turn it on like that? And look, I get it. Like, it's a long season, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an 82-game season, and not every period is going to look good. Not every period is going to look like you're at your best. But that's been happening way too often for the Predators as of late. And we're getting to the point now, like I said, it's critical mass. You got to get it figured out or it's going to be too late.
They're almost what? They're almost at the halfway point, if not at the halfway point right about now. And if we just take what happened the first half and duplicate it to the second half, this team's not making the playoffs.
Yeah.
They're just not making the playoffs. They have to start playing, you know, consistent hockey. They got to go on a roll. Just like they went on that, you know, 7-game losing streak, I think they have to have a month, in particular this month, where they win, you know, 7-8 games.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be in a row or 8 out of 10, somewhere around it. They have to win a lot of games and accumulate a lot of points, I think, in this month of January, or probably, you know, now into early February. Because if they don't, then the likelihood of them making it to the playoffs is going to be slim. You know, this team, from the goalies, to the way they play defense at times, the way they play offense at times, the power play has gotten a little bit better. They had a power play last night, the other night, I mean.
Yeah.
It's just not what we're accustomed to seeing from the Nashville Predators. And why it's happening, I don't know, because it seems like this is a better team. Maybe not leaps and bounds better than what they were last year, but they were a good team last year.
Sure.
And obviously they've changed players and they're still a good team. You just wonder, why is it that a good team is playing so inconsistent? And Munson brought this up early off air. You always try to find an equivalent, you know, and you try to pair two sports together some way. And we were trying to say, well, who are the Nashville Predators if you were to put them on the football field? And at first I said they're the Cleveland Browns, but they're not dysfunctional like the Browns. And their coach is not incompetent like Freddie Kitchens is.
Right.
So we started to think more, and Munson said the Cowboys. And he's absolutely right. All his talent, the coach is good, but somehow, some way, they hadn't been able to put it on. They hadn't been able to take the talent and make it consistent on the ice this year.
No, there's no question. And I think the one thing you look at for a glass half full approach, if you're a Predators fan and maybe there's some hope, is you've played in fewer games than everybody in the Western Conference. So, for instance, you're, I think, 4 points behind the Calgary Flames right now in terms of the last playoff spot, and they've played 3 more games than you have. So you win those games, and all of a sudden you're feeling a lot better about yourself and you're in the playoffs. The problem is you got to win those games. You got to take advantage of these games in hand that you have. And there have been times this year where the Predators have been able to do that. I think last night was a golden opportunity for them to do that again, and they've let a point fall by the wayside. So that's going to be something they're going to have to figure out. It's one thing to have the games in hand. You got to take advantage of them when you get them.
So are those games, will they, because I think last year was like that. They end up at the end of the season, they had 1 or 2 more games left.
Yeah.
Then I think the team they were vying for.
Yeah, Winnipeg, I think.
Yeah, Winnipeg, yeah. Where they were trying to figure out who's going to be fourth or fifth place or third and fourth place. And they had those games at the end where Winnipeg was done and the Preds still had a game or two left.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's one of those things where you look at the first half of the schedule, and I think it's been pretty favorable to the Predators in terms of the travel, in terms of not playing too many back-to-backs. Well, that's going to catch up to you, because if you've played in fewer games than anybody else in the West the first half of the year, that means in the second half you're going to play more games than anybody else. So that's something you have to be ready for. I thought UC Saros last night, for the most part, was really, really good for the Predators. He kind of got hung out to dry on the penalty kill there in the second period. But early on in that game, when they got outshot 21-4, it was 1-1 after the first period. It could have easily been 5 or 6-1 for Anaheim. They had a lot of point-blank chances. But that, to me, is going to be, if this team is going to go anywhere this year, these two goaltenders are going to have to figure it out and carry the weight. Both of them have save percentages below 900 right now, and that's just not going to get it done. So to me, the biggest thing that has to change in the second half of the year, regardless of the personnel and the way that the system is run and all this other stuff, the goaltenders have to stop the pucks that they should stop. And to me, that could make the difference in this team being a playoff team or not. And we just haven't seen that consistently enough, to your point, D-Mace, so far this year.
Do you think, because I don't know the answer to this, obviously you can put the blame. It's 50-50, whether you want to say the staff has more blame than the players or the players have more blame than the staff. I think it all works hand in hand.
Sure.
I think, if there's something being taught and you don't go out there and implement it, then, okay, it's the player's fault. If there's something that needs to be changed or some adjustments that need to be made and you don't make them, then obviously it's on the staff. So I think it's – and I'm not saying that's happening, but I think it's a 50-50 thing when talking about this team, because they're just so inconsistent. Do you think this system fits this particular team? Not last year's team, not the year before, not when Lavi first got here, but this team, the system that they're running, does it fit this team?
It's hard for me to say yes to that mm-hmm. question. I think Peter Laviolette's a really good coach. It's no accident that you've taken, three different teams to the Stanley Cup final. Mm-hmm. But I also think there are times where you need to look at your system and look at the players that you have and make some adjustments. I don't think they've done a good enough job of that this year. I mean, look, let's be honest here. I mean, everybody needs to be better with that group. The coaches, the players, everybody needs to be better. Other than Roman Josi, who, by the way, is just having an unbelievable year. He's on a 10-game point streak right now. He may end up putting up 85, 90 points this year as a defenseman, which is just absolutely absurd. He's doing everything he can to bring this team along with him. But I think everybody needs to be better. And, I've said this for months now, the system, I don't think, it's unfixable. I think there are things you can do to utilize the talent that you have. Like, I don't believe that Kyle Turris just forgot how to play hockey. I don't believe Mikael Granlund isn't a good hockey player anymore. But I don't think they're being maximized right now to the best of their abilities. I think sometimes that goes hand in hand when you have defensemen who are as active and are as good as the Predators have in terms of Josi and Ellis and Ekholm. A lot of times they're carrying the puck a lot more than you typically would see on your traditional team, and sometimes that takes away from the offensive creativity of your forwards. Now, it kind of balances out with the creativity that Josi has as well, but that's a long way of saying, yes, I think there are some system adjustments that they could make to maximize this talent much better than they have so far this year, and I think that they're going to have to do that in the second half of the season if they're going to go anywhere. So it'll be interesting to see if the Predators are able to do that. When we come back, it was a wild, wild card weekend in the NFL, obviously highlighted by the Titans' big win over the Patriots. We'll talk about that next here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Derek Mason and Marquise Munson. D-Mace, huge win for the Titans over the weekend, a dominant performance by Derrick Henry, and we talked about this earlier in the show, but it was amazing to me, and Tony Romo talked about it on the broadcast, and I think Taylor Lewan mentioned it after the game. There was a certain point in the game on Saturday when you could just tell that New England knew what was coming. They knew that Derrick Henry was about to pound the rock. They knew where he was going with the ball, and they still could do absolutely nothing about it. And to me, I can't imagine more of a helpless feeling as a defense than knowing where the ball is going, knowing who's getting the ball, and still not being able to stop it.
Yeah, that is just, they knew that at the beginning of the game. I think they knew that the only way the Tennessee Titans are going to beat us is if they run the ball. So they knew they were going to get a heavy dose of Derrick Henry. They knew it. It was, how do we stop it? Because I don't think they faced the back like Derrick Henry all season.
He's a freight train.
Yeah, he's the best runner in the National Football League. And on a side note, I don't understand why he didn't make All-Pro. That's just that's a damn shame. But anyway, they knew that it was going to be hard to stop him. But the thing about you know, the NFL, and I think a lot of basketball too, and even, you know, taking it back to Roman Yossi, you mentioned the season that he's having and what he could potentially end up with. That's one thing. There's one thing to game plan for a guy and to know that he's going to be the focus of the game. There's another to actually plan it, like when you line up and you see the guy,
yeah,
and you got to go against him. Yeah, Roman Yossi's great, and we're going to game plan, and we're going to do this. But then when the kid's out on the ice, it's like, how do we stop him?
Yeah, what do we do about this?
What do we do? All this stuff that we wanted to do, we can't. Derrick Henry, the same way. It's like, you know, with LeBron James, Michael Jordan. Yes, we're going to put three guys. We still can't stop him.
Yeah.
Derrick Henry, we're going to put eight men on a line of scrimmage. Eight. They only got five that can block. Eight men on a line of scrimmage. We still can't stop this guy. What do we do? Nothing. Yeah. You can't do anything.
It's something that comes down to physics, too, man. Like, you get the ball to Derrick Henry, he can run 20 miles an hour, and he's basically built like a refrigerator. It's almost impossible to tackle that guy. I've been, you know, standing next to Derrick Henry on the sideline when I covered the Titans a couple years ago, it is incredible how big he is. I've been next to LeBron James, and he's a gigantic human being. Derrick Henry is one of the only human beings where it like almost took my breath away of how big he is, especially when he's moving that fast, running the rock. You're like, how in the world does anybody ever tackle this guy?
He's always, and he's bigger. It seems like he's just a bigger presence now than he was 2 years ago, because he's a veteran and he understands what's going on. So he's just a bigger presence now. But he's always been the biggest guy, it seems like, on the field. Whether you watch clips, they show clips of him
his
in
high school?
School. Yeah.
Can you imagine tackling him in high school?
No, I'm not tackling that guy.
I remember there was one game where Mark Ingram was at the game, and Derrick Henry was playing, and Derrick Henry was right beside Mark Ingram, and it looked like Derrick Henry was like his
father. Yeah.
It was like Mark Ingram was the son, and he's watching him play.
Yeah, the dude is just massive. And he's figured out that he's a really good running back. He's figured out that when I step on the field, I am the best player. More likely than not, when he steps on the field, look at everybody that they've played. He has been the best player on the field, minus Brent Kern. But he has been the best player on the field. You look at him.
Yeah.
Even when they played New Orleans. Yes, but he wasn't on the field then. So Michael Thomas was. But when Derrick Henry has been on the field, he's been the best player, and he's proven it. And it's hard to game plan. Well, it's easy to game plan for him, but it's hard to execute that game plan. Like you said, everybody got a plan till you get punched in the mouth.
That's right.
And then your plan, whatever plan you had, goes out the window.
That's right.
Well, everybody had a plan for Derrick Henry Saturday until he ran through you. Then that plan you had goes out of the window. And now everybody's looking around. Somebody make a tackle. Because what we were doing schematically ain't working.
And you could just tell once that game got into the fourth quarter and he was still churning those legs and breaking off those runs, it's just human nature. Patriots, they didn't want to tackle him. They wanted no part of going up to him and wrapping him up. I mean, they just wanted no part of it. So credit to Mike Vrabel and the Titans coaching staff for sticking with the run. And speaking of the coaching staff, how much credit do you give them for what we saw against the Patriots on Saturday? Because it's not very often that you go into a game and you can outcoach a team that's head coached by Bill Belichick. But I thought the Titans did that on Saturday.
I think they did outcoach and Bill Belichick. And not to say Bill did a bad coaching job. He didn't. They just did a better coaching job. I think there were maybe one or two blunders they had, Bill Belichick. One was toward the end of the game when they chose to not have somebody back there catching the ball,
yeah,
even if it was a fair catch. And it ran off maybe an extra 5, 6, 7 seconds. I didn't understand that. But for the most part, this coaching staff, first and foremost, you say, Arthur Smith, but Arthur knew what he was doing. He knew what he was going to do coming into the game.
Sure.
He knew we got to run the football. We just got to run the football. We continue to run the football. And I don't think New England ever did anything, or they never got the score that far ahead where Arthur Smith then had to change his game plan. So they stayed the course. That offense and Arthur Smith stayed the course. It was Dean Pease. It was Dean Pease that had to put together a defense to stop New England without having some of his players. And then to lose Jayon Brown, you had to change it a little bit more. So what they were able to do in the secondary, because frankly, I mean, Adoree wasn't still 100%, and, you know, there was still some rust in him. But Dean Pease put together a really good game plan to neutralize whatever New England thought they were going to be able to do, because they were going against one of the worst pass defenses in the National Football League, meaning the Titans, over the course the last half of the season.
Yep.
And the Titans neutralized all that. So take a hat off to Dean Pease and what he was able to do.
Vrabel pulled the move in the fourth quarter that was very Belichick-esque in its style. And it was, I think the Titans had the ball on like the 38-yard line, the 40-yard line in New England's territory. And it was right on the edge of field goal range, but not where you were really comfortable kicking a field goal, which if you've seen the Titans kick field goals at all this year, you're never comfortable with them kicking a field goal. But he let the clock run down. They took a delay of game penalty, and then the clock continued to run, and then they took another false start penalty, and then I think New England jumped offside, and then they took another false start penalty. And it ran off about a minute and 40 seconds on the clock, and Belichick was furious on the sideline. But it was just one of those things where you could say, okay, there's Mike Vrabel. He learned that from some guy named Bill Belichick, and it's not often you see a technique like that used against Belichick. It was entertaining, to say the least.
Yeah, I think that's what – I mean, I don't know why Bill was furious. Bill would have did it on his side.
Exactly.
I think more and more you're starting to see these coaches use these loopholes within the rules of the NFL. And maybe that's a rule they end up, you know, changing, you know, moving forward. But it's a loophole. And we saw Bill Belichick do it before. And Vrabel's done it. I'm pretty sure there are other teams that have done it or found some type of way to run time off the clock or stop the clock when they needed to be stopped. So these coaches, that's why you got to have a coach, not necessarily an X's and O's head coach, even though there are a lot of them out there. But you got to have a coach that understands the moment of the game, that understands the rules of the game. Not necessarily, he doesn't have to be the greatest X's and O's guys, but if you know the game and understand the rules of the game and understand timing within the game and what you can do, then those coaches are better suited to be, you know, head coaches. Because if I had to depend on Vrabel calling plays, Titans wouldn't be 9-7.
Oh, yeah.
They'd be much worse than 9-7.
Yeah.
But he's a smart head coach. He understands what's going on just about at all times.
Yeah, I thought it was a great move, and it's always kind of a seed of doubt when you run that risk and you run off that much time, and you still look at the other side of the sideline, you say, "Ooh, that's number 12 coming out for the Patriots." So, you know, everybody had that seed of doubt creep in, but obviously it worked out really well for the Titans. A good defensive performance by the Titans, particularly in the second quarter when their backs were against the wall. D-Mace and I will talk about that on the other side here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. And welcome back in to Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Talking the Titans' big win over the New England Patriots this past Saturday. And D-Mace, there was a critical point in this game in the second quarter, late in the second quarter. The Patriots were driving the ball down the field. They were leading 10-7 at the time, I believe, and got the ball on the one-yard line. And Rashawn Evans made three plays, two in particular that were really good solo plays, but another play on Rex Burkhead as well, to make the goal line stand and hold the Patriots to a field goal late in the second quarter. And obviously, given the way the rest of the game played out, that was huge. But that was for a red zone defense that at times has struggled this year in the Titans. That was about as big of a moment in this game as it gets, I think.
That was, I think, ultimately, that is what won the Tennessee Titans that game. That particular play, because the way things were going, it was going to be hard for them to score. And, you know, you give New England, you know, 14 points, and that's, it would have been, what, 17,
yeah.
I believe?
Yeah.
They go up 17-7, somewhere yeah. around there. That's hard to come by the way that game was going. But the Tennessee Titans did exactly what they were supposed to do. They did it before earlier in the season when they beat the San Diego Chargers, L.A. Chargers, excuse me. They had a goal line stand, ended up getting the fumble on the last play. Ultimately, that's probably the game that helped get them into the playoffs, because if they lose that game, they start off 2-5, I think, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And it's hard to come back from that. So you can say that play got them in the playoffs, potentially. This play saved the game for them, I believe. It was a game-stopping play that ultimately was the deciding play that ultimately had them win that game, because they stopped Tom Brady in that offense and they make him kick a field goal. If they score, I don't think the Titans win in that game. So Harold Landry, take your hats off to him. He did an excellent job at reading it, the first one, you know, jumping over one blocker and making the tackle on Michelle. And then the second play, you know, getting an assist, him being there. So you had the two Alabama guys, you know, make big plays yeah. or play big in a situation where they needed to play big. Derrick Henry and Rashawn
yeah.
Evans.
Yeah.
And, you know, take a, he played like a veteran guy. He played like a guy that was in a, that's been in the league 5-6 years.
Yeah.
You're starting to see now he's starting to come into form. This whole season, he's starting to come into form. He's starting to figure it out. And he knows now how to read and recognize defenses. He understands, I mean, offenses. He understands, you know, if a guy's here, this is what I'm going to do. If a guy's there, you know, if all running back's offset, he's starting to recognize these things now. And that's now he's going to be able to play with instinct mm-hmm. like he did in Alabama. If he can do that, he will ultimately be one of the best linebackers in the NFL.
And that's exactly what he did. I'm glad you brought up that point. That's exactly mm-hmm. what he did in that situation, because I think in his rookie year, you know, you've got a million things running through your mm-hmm. mind through training camp. You're trying to learn a new defensive system. You're trying to learn where to be. The NFL game obviously is a ton more complex than it is in college football. Even at Alabama, there are mm-hmm. some steps that you have to take. But he just, on the goal line stand against the Patriots, it was quick. It was boom. You don't even have to think about it. You're reading what's going on. You're diagnosing it as you're moving, and you're reacting immediately. And that, to me, more than anything, shows the progression he's had from year one to year two.
Yeah, and he's only going to get better, barring injury. And, you know, this trio of linebackers that they have, they're young, and all of them have it. All these linebackers have a different skill set, but they all work together. And I think Rashawn Evans heads it all up. I know Jayon Brown is there and the other guys because they run this 3-4. But I think because of the way Rashawn Evans plays, his ability now to recognize, read and recognize, he's becoming – a smart linebacker. It's not just all, you know, physical with right. him. If you want to be one of the greatest linebackers in the NFL, you got to be mentally above everyone. You look at all the linebackers that were considered great. Ray Lewis, Singletary. I mean, you can go down the line. These guys, not only that they have did they have the physical attributes, Brian Urlacher, but they understood the game. Yeah. Once they understood the game, it took him to another level. Rashawn Evans could be one of these guys if he continues to learn, and he showed Saturday that he's taking that step.
And you know better than anybody that once we get to this time of year, the teams, by and large, are pretty equal. I mean, there, mm-hmm. there are teams, obviously your favorites, like, you know, the Ravens and the Chiefs and the NFC, the Niners. But by and large, the talent level is fairly equal, and it comes down to how do you perform in critical situations? Mm-hmm. And that's going to be the difference in the game. And I thought the Titans made more plays than the Patriots did in that aspect. Although they did let one slip away. Yeah. Logan Ryan had a very easy interception opportunity late in the first half that let slide through his fingertips, which he ultimately made up for later. But I thought the Titans did a good job of when you had to make the plays, whether it was, you know, a third and four or a third and three run that they gave to Derrick Henry or the goal line stand, mm-hmm. they did a much better job of making those plays than New England did, and ultimately that was the difference.
There were, let me think, there were four plays maybe. And if you guys, I'm gonna give out these three, but if you guys have others that you think that were key plays in this game, then by no means say them. But there were three plays, I believe, that ultimately end up winning them this game. Obviously, the goal line stand was one. The pass to Firkser late in the game, where it was, I think it was third and like eight.
Yeah.
And if New England stops them, they get excellent field position. And that play, that out route by Firkser, and Ryan Tannehill delivered it on a dime.
Best throw of the day by exactly. Tannehill by far.
Delivered it on a dime. That was the second one. But I think the last one for me was the touchdown pass, honestly, because they were – That was a blitz up the middle. They had up the middle pressure. And if he doesn't get that ball away with accuracy, they stop the Tennessee Titans, and it's a field goal instead of a touchdown.
Yeah.
Ryan Tannehill stood in the pocket. The rush was coming right at him in his face. He found somehow, some way, he delivered that ball with the guy like inches away from him and hit Firkser on a touchdown pass. It was, again, a perfect pass to Firkser. That started it off. So to me, those three plays, to me, ultimately, what are deciding factors in the Titans winning that game.
I agree, and you talked about the difference in the playoffs earlier being the attention to detail mm-hmm. that you have to pay attention to, and I think what you just said describes that perfectly. Those three plays, a couple of them, even, you know, the out route to Firkser, maybe it doesn't seem like a big deal in the grand scheme of things, but those are the plays you have to make to play winning football in January.
Yeah, especially if you're going to beat New England.
Yeah.
Because New England's not going to give you a lot of opportunities. You know, they're not going to make a lot of mistakes. They're not going to beat themselves. You know, the Titans almost beat themselves, but they were able to regroup. Even on the interception, the way the defense played after the interception was huge. Because again, we talked about this earlier. Typically in the playoffs, New England gets you in a situation like that, you make a mistake late in the game and the game's close, they usually capitalize and game over.
You're in trouble.
Checkmate. It's our game. But the Titans didn't. The Titans stood firm. That defense played really good on that series, and they didn't allow New England to then go down and score a touchdown.
Full credit to the Titans defense. I know that the Patriots offense is not and has not been what we've been accustomed to seeing from that group. But I thought the Titans defense, particularly obviously in the second half, played extremely well and played about as well, I think, as you could have expected from them.
Yeah, they did. You know, Dean Pease did an excellent job. He called the game plan that he needed to call to win that particular football game. Yes, this wasn't the New England offense that we're accustomed to seeing. But that's not the Titans' fault.
No.
You know, it's New England's fault. You know, but in the Titans just took advantage of it. They did exactly what they were supposed to do, even in the midst of losing one of their better players on defense. They still, you know, played within the defense, didn't give up anything deep, and kept everything in front of them. Didn't put as much pressure on Tom Brady as they probably would have liked to, but they did enough in the secondary to not let him do what he wanted to do in the passing game. Those receivers didn't get any separation.
No.
None whatsoever. So kudos to the Titans and Dean Pease.
D-Mace, when we come back, Munson has a very special edition of Stick to Sports with us. It's going to be exhilarating. That's on the other side here on Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Getting supplies for my business as simple and seamless as possible. When it comes to getting things done, it's a win-win when Grainger's got your back. Call clickgrainger.com or stop by to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We can all agree Nashville traffic can be a drag. But Jared and the GM rarely agree on anything.
He had nothing to risk by challenging that call, and he had the ball game
to
win.
He had 100 out of 100 times they will not overturn
that. That's not true.
That is absolutely true.
Daily entertainment while you sit in rush hour traffic.
His head and face are first down, but the ball's not in his mouth.
Tune in to Jared and the GM, weekdays 2 to 6.
On ESPN.
102.5 The Game.
Hey, this is Pecorine. You're listening to Nashville's best sports talk, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Derek Mason and Marquise Munson. And Marquise, it's that time to stick to sports.
The world is a crazy place.
Crazy sounding pretty good right now.
Let's lighten the mood.
After all that seriousness, you're just going to crumple it up and throw it in the trash.
And stick to sports. Now, on Morning Drive.
All right, this is a different edition of Stick to Sports.
Special edition.
We got a lot of sports going on. So we're going to actually stick to sports because there's a lot of sports going on that we didn't get to discuss because obviously the Titans get a huge win in the playoffs. So obviously that took over majority of the show. But there's a lot of other stuff going on in the world of sports that we'll kind of talk about in a probably a funny way or so. So let's get started.
Number one.
All right. So the homie Jason Garrett. Now, Jason Garrett had an interesting weekend. He was sitting on the porch with his homie Smokey, and they were discussing about, you know, his future plans with the Cowboys, but there is no plans for the Cowboys because Jason Garrett is gone, folks. I don't know how many times he got fired this week.
I think about six.
I don't know how many times he got fired this weekend, but he got fired. And it's funny because they announced it. Like, I got the Jay Glazer, like, report from it. Like, during the game, during the Eagles game.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what way to announce you're getting fired from the Cowboys job than during an Eagles game while the Eagles are getting, you know, mollywopped by the Seahawks. But Jason Garrett gone, finally, from the Cowboys.
I thought he got fired twice already. This is the third time he got fired.
Yeah, they like hired a coach already, a new one. They've interviewed four people.
Hey, Jason.
My new wife's coming.
We gotta hire a new coach. You gotta leave the office, man.
Jason, your security guard hadn't worked in 4 days. You gotta get out of here, man.
Jason Garrett has that one security guard that always lets him in still, because he doesn't know no better.
Yeah, he doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I just forgot my key card. Like, no, it just doesn't work anymore, Jason. Hey,
we need to commandeer that office. Jason Garrett, you need to get up out of there.
Mike McCarthy's on his way in.
We got Mike coming in, so you need to leave.
We got a young, hotter wife in the lobby, and her name is Lincoln Riley.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You got to go. I'm sorry. You got to go. You got to leave. You ain't got to leave Dallas, but you got to leave this building.
Leave here.
I'm pretty sure the XFL's hired.
Oh, absolutely. He'd get a job as a coordinator somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, see, that's the thing. I think – now, I don't know who the Cowboys' decision to, you know, get yet. Now, rumors are swirling around. It might be Lincoln Riley. They're going to bring in Marvin Lewis and Mike McCarthy. They're going to also probably even talk to Urban Meyer. So, if I were to give you one coach to hire for the Cowboys, if you're Jerry Jones, which you probably won't listen to us anyway because – he only listens to himself.
He does whatever he wants.
He does whatever he wants. But if you were to give him a suggestion, who would your suggestion be for?
Oh, man.
I think they need a coach with experience. I think that roster is talented enough to win now. My suggestion would be Mike McCarthy. I think with the offense he ran in Green Bay and just the long run of success that he had there, he's obviously a coach that come in, he can handle the spotlight, he can handle all the aspects that go along with it. But the biggest problem to me is Jerry Jones has got to relinquish some control of this team. And until he does that, I'm not sure what the upside of the Dallas Cowboys is going to be.
This is the coach that I would hire for one reason and one reason only. Because I don't want my, as we had last time, I don't want my head coach calling plays. I don't want him to even suggest a lot of plays. I want him to just be the head coach. That's all you're doing. Just the head coach. You are the CEO. And you hire good. Yeah. I like Harbaugh. I'm hiring Marvin Lewis because he doesn't need to call plays. He has a good record in regards to wins and losses during the regular season. He's not going to give Jerry Jones any pushback. That's why he didn't leave Cincinnati. Yeah. He didn't give any pushback.
And the players love him.
And the players would love him. And then I would hire one of the I would hire one of the hottest offensive coordinators out there and defensive coordinators. But I would hire Marvin Lewis only because I know he would just coach the team, not call him plays, just coach the team. That's all I need you to do. And then he's not going to get Jerry any fuss. So Jerry likes that too.
Yeah, Jerry, like, leave me alone. Just win games. That's all I just ask for.
Number two.
All right. So after the show's over, and it'll be probably, I'll say, around 9:56, 57, I'm out of here. I'm leaving because I got to go get clean my apartment because the Tua watch party in Lower Antioch is going down. 11 o'clock. We got to watch. Tua's going to make his announcement on his future, whether he's going to stay at Alabama or whether he's going to go to the NFL draft. Now, Mel Kiper's got him as one of the top three, you know, players in his mock draft, but a lot of people are speculating that he could come back for another year, recover, and maybe even play. So if you were Tua, or if you were Tua's camp, if you're Tua's homies, what would you be telling Tua to do?
I mean, there's nothing else. Listen, the last two seasons, he's had the greatest season of any Alabama quarterback. And he's probably, from an efficiency standpoint, he's had the two of the greatest seasons just about of any quarterback in college football.
Yeah.
His completion ratio is off the charts. His efficiency is off the charts. So I would tell him to go, man. There's nothing else, because either this year or next year, you're going to be the second quarterback taken.
Yeah.
Because next year is going to be Trevor Lawrence. You're going to be taken after Trevor Lawrence. But I think because his offensive lineman, his best offensive lineman, was it Leatherwood? He chose to stay.
Oh, yeah, Leatherwood staying. Yeah. Jedrick Wells is gone.
Exactly. So one of his better offensive linemen are choosing to stay. He's choosing to stay. I think there's a part of me says he comes back for an air. Because listening to what people have said about Tua, his career there, he doesn't want to go out the way he went out.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I think he comes back.
I think he's going to go. And to be honest with you, the only reason I think this is a conversation is because of the injury. And because of the injury is a conversation, the only reason that's the case is because, okay, am I going to slide down in the draft? Am I going to go maybe late first round, maybe early second round because of this injury? Maybe teams are hesitant. Well, all the draft boards I look at, he's still the second quarterback going. So if that's the case, I agree with you, D-Mace. I think he should go now because I think that'll be the case once again next year.
Exactly.
Look, it doesn't matter if it's the Dolphins, if it's one of these playoff teams, that if Tua does Tua's not sliding out of the first round.
No.
Let's just be clear. He's not going to slide out of the first round. And I have to talk to Alabama fans about this because they see that Nick Saban's going to be at the press conference as well, and everybody's making – I even heard national people making this big deal. Saban's going to be there, so is it a possibility that they say – let me tell you guys what Saban does every year. Anytime juniors announce that they're going to the draft, Saban does a press conference – to say, hey, these are the guys that are going to the draft.
He's supporting them.
Yeah, so thanks for all you've done for Alabama.
Yeah, so
we wish you luck.
Basically, this is one of those instances where everybody's like, uh-oh, Nick Saban's joining the press conference. That means he's probably staying. No, that means he's leaving. That is a strong indication that he's leaving. Now, Tua may be the headliner of this, and they'll have like four or five empty chairs, which means that there'll be four or five more guys that are going to be sitting in those chairs announcing that they're going to the draft. So Jerry Jeudy, you know, Wells will be up there, all those guys. I know how these things work. Just because Nick Saban is going to be talking there does not mean that he's staying. I think Tua's probably out of here.
Yeah, but there's a big part of me that thinks he's gone, but then there is a small part that says, I don't want to go out, being injured.
Absolutely.
I want to win another national championship.
And plus, like, the way, not only the way he went out, but just, you know, knowing that he had this hype on him to win the Heisman, to, you know, the national championship game that he probably can't get back, you know, all those things being considered. I think he's leaving, but I wouldn't be shocked if he comes back.
And then I think he probably, you know, he probably wants to graduate.
That too.
That could be, you know, in his mind too. I want to graduate, and, you know, it'd be a little bit harder if I go to the NFL and then try to come back during the offseason to do it. I'd rather just get it out of the way, and then the second semester I don't have to do anything.
But then also, I don't think – there's another thing, too, that which makes me think he's going. I don't think he wants to take the shine from his little brother, who's also on the roster.
Yeah.
And his little brother has a – good possibility of starting next year if it's him and Mac. So
Mac played good during the bowl game.
He did. He played really well. But I just think that that can be one aspect of it, of just, look, I don't want to take a spot from my little brother. I know that he's going to be competing for this job, so I'll probably just head out and go get that money. Because, I mean, NFL money sitting on the bench for your rookie year, he can just do the Ben Simmons thing. Ben Simmons did it before. Joel Embiid's done it. All these NBA guys who get drafted number one overall, they sit out their whole entire rookie year and then come back better than ever the next year.
Hey, he might be taking a pay cut if you leave
Might
Alabama.
Be if he's leaving Alabama. Isn't that how it works down there?
Yeah, Munson.
Yeah.
This is all allegedly. I don't know what these guys are talking about. I've never seen a player ever drive a Camaro. I don't know what you're talking about. Derrick Henry was driving a bucket.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
to 1996 Honda Accord.
Oh, man.
These are all legends. All right, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. I hope everybody enjoyed our special edition of Stick to Sports.
We had to get those out the way, man. Oh, yeah. Those are some big
those
stories.
Those are some big items.
Yeah,
those
there were many stories. More big stories, but we only had time to get to those.
It's a great time for sports, great time for football specifically this time of year. When we come back, our good buddy Darren McFarland from Darren, Donick, and Chase will join us. That's on the other side here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. You're listening to Morning Drive live from the Wholesale Inc. studio, powered by RumbleOn.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.